Welcome back to A Book A Day podcast. And if you remember in the previous podcast, I was narrating short stories by Saadat Hasan Manto. And once again, this is what I'm going to do. Narrate another short story by Manto in this podcast. Manto, as you know, he wrote his stories in Urdu language. And a lot of his stories revolve around the culture in India and Pakistan, the social and political landscape, the taboos that prevail in the societies or used to prevail in the society back then, around 1940s, 1950s. And it is in this context that our next short story is set. It's called The Dutiful Daughter. And I'm going to narrate it now. So let's begin. The Dutiful Daughter. The country had been divided. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims and Hindus were moving from India to Pakistan and from Pakistan to India in search of refuge. Camps had been set up to give them temporary shelter. But they were so overcrowded that it seemed quite impossible to push another human being into them. And yet, more refugees were being brought in every day. There wasn't enough food to go around, and basic facilities were almost non-existent. Epidemics and infections were common, but it did not bother anybody. Such were the times. The year 1948 had begun. Hundreds of volunteers had been assigned the task of recovering abducted women and children and restoring them to their families. They would go in groups to India from Pakistan and from Pakistan to India to make their recoveries. It always amused me to see that such enthusiastic efforts were being made to undo the effects of something which had been penetrated by more or less the same people. Why were they trying to rehabilitate the women who had been raped and taken away when they had let them be raped and taken away in the first place? It was all very confusing, but one still admired the devotion of these volunteers. It was not a simple task. The difficulties were enormous. The abductors were not easy to trace. To avoid discovery, they had devised various means of eluding their pursuers. They were constantly on the move from this locality to that, from one city to another. One followed a tip and often found nothing at the end of the trail. One heard strange stories. One officer told me that in Saharanpur, two abducted Muslim girls had refused to return to their parents who were in Pakistan. Then there was this Muslim girl in Jalandhar who was given a touching farewell by the abductor's family as if she was a daughter-in-law living on a long journey. Some girls had committed suicide on the way, afraid of facing their parents. Some had lost their mental balance as a result of their traumatic experiences. Others had become alcoholics and used abusive and vulgar language when spoken to. When I thought about these abducted girls, I only saw their protruding bellies. What was going to happen to them and what they contained? Who would claim the end result, Pakistan or India? And who would pay the women the wages for carrying those children in their wombs for 9 months? Pakistan or India? Or would it all be put down in God's great ledger if there were still any pages left? The abducted women were being moved from this side to that and that side to this all the time. Why were they being described as abducted women? I had always thought that when a woman ran away from home with her lover, The police always called it abduction. It was the most romantic act in the world. But these women had been taken against their will and violated. They were strange, illogical times. I had boarded up all the doors and windows of my mind, shuttered them up. It was difficult to think straight. Sometimes it seemed to me that the entire operation was being conducted like import-export trade. One officer told me, or rather asked me, "Why do you look lost?" I did not answer his question. And then he told me a story. He said, "We were looking for abducted women from town to town, village to village, street to street, and days would go by, sometimes before we would have any success. And almost every time I went across to what has now become India, I would notice an old woman, the same old woman. The first time, it was in the suburbs of Jalandhar. She looked distracted, almost unaware of her surroundings. Her eyes had a desolate look, her clothes had turned to rags, and her hair was coated with dust. The only thing that struck me about her was that she was looking for someone. I was told by one of the women volunteers that she had lost her mind, because her only daughter had been abducted during the riots in Patiala. She said they had tried for months to find the girl, but had failed. In all probability, she had been killed, but that was something the old woman was not prepared to believe. The next time I ran into her at Saharanpur, she was at the bus stop and she looked much worse than she had the first time I had seen her. Her lips were cracked and her hair looked matted. I spoke to her. I said she should abandon her futile search. And to induce her to follow my advice, I told her it was brutal, that her daughter had probably been murdered. She looked at me. "Murdered? No, no one can murder my daughter. No one can murder my daughter." And she walked away. It set me thinking, why was this crazy woman so confident that no one could murder her daughter, that no sharp deadly knife could slash her throat? Did she think her daughter was immortal, or was it her motherhood which would not admit defeat, not certain about the death? On my third visit, I saw her again in another town. She looked very old and ragged. Her clothes were now so threadbare that they hardly covered her frail body. I gave her a change of dress, but she did not want to. I said to her, "Old woman, I swear to you that your daughter was killed in Patiala." "You are lying," she said. There was steely conviction in her voice. To convince her, I said, "I assure you I'm telling the truth. You have suffered enough. It's time to go to Pakistan and I will take you." She paid no attention to what I had said and began muttering to herself, "No one can murder my daughter." And she suddenly declared in a strong, confident voice, "Why?" I asked. "Because she's beautiful. She's so beautiful that no one can kill her. No one could even dream of hurting her," she said. I wondered if her daughter was really as beautiful as she described. And then I thought, all children are beautiful to their mother. It's also possible that the old woman is right. Who knows? But in this Holocaust, nothing has survived. This mad old woman is deceiving herself. There are so many ways of escape from unpleasant reality. Grief is like a roundabout which one intersects with an infinite number of roads. I made many other trips across the border to India, and almost every time I somehow ran into the old woman. She was more than rather no more than a bag of bones now. She could hardly see and tottered about like a blind person, a step at a time. Only one thing had not changed: her faith that her daughter was alive and that no one could kill her. One of the women volunteers said to me, "Don't waste your time over her. She's raving mad. It would be good if you could take her to Pakistan with you and put her in an asylum." Suddenly, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to divest her of her only reason for living. As it was, she was in a vast asylum where nothing made any sense. I did not wish to confine her within the four walls of a regular one. The last time I met her was in Amritsar. She looked so broken that it almost brought tears to my eyes. I decided that I would make one last effort to take her to Pakistan. There she stood in Farid Chowk, peering around with her half-blind eyes. I was talking to a shopkeeper about an abducted Muslim girl who, we had been informed, was being kept in the house of a Hindu moneylender. After my exchange with the shopkeeper, I crossed the street, determined to persuade the old woman to come with me to Pakistan. I noticed a couple. The woman's face was partly covered by her white chadar. The man was young and handsome, a Sikh. As they went past the old woman, the man suddenly stopped. He even fell back a step or two. Nervously, he caught hold of the woman's hand. I could not see her full face, but one glimpse had been enough to show that she was beautiful beyond words. "Your mother," he said to her. The girl looked up, but only for a second. Then, covering her face with her chadar, she grabbed her companion's arm and said, "Let's get away from here." They crossed the road, taking long, brisk steps. The old woman shouted, "Baghbari, Baghbari." I rushed towards her. "What's the matter?" I asked. She was trembling. "I've seen her, I've seen her." "Whom have you seen?" I asked. "I've seen my daughter, I've seen Baghbari." Her eyes were like burnt out lights. "But your daughter is dead," I said. "You are lying," she screamed. "I swear on God your daughter is dead." The old woman then fell in a heap on the road. And that's how our story ends. Once again, you'll see the tragedy, but something that is so close to reality and something that really happened. These are the kind of events that took place during the partition back in 1947-48. And although Manto write a number of such stories, but I think all these events and all these stories, they really changed him. And then he became alcoholic and did not really live for a long time.